The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing. Not because they are easy, but
we
because they are hard.
Start. 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston, broadcasting to 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good afternoon, listeners. Welcome to our Monday Space Show program. I am your host, David Livingston. Thanks for tuning in. Gorgeous afternoon for the San Francisco Bay Area. I hope wherever you are, it is equally as nice. And so much for the weather report. We have a great show for you today, but first a little bit of housekeeping. The toll-free number, if you would like to call in, 1-866-687-7223. Remember, no call screeners. Be patient. We'll answer and bring you up on air as quickly as possible. For those of you intimidated by the telephone, email works, and that is drspace, D-R-S-P-A-C-E, at thespaceshow.com. But we do prefer the phones. And do go to our website, thespaceshow.com. So we have a newly designed website newsletter, but more important, if you continue to the right side of the homepage and scroll down a little bit, you will see the block for upcoming shows. These are the programs planned for the current week. And once you see a show listed in upcoming shows, you're ready to go blogging on that. You can post comments even before the show airs. I get those comments and can read them on air either during the show or if they come in during the show, just as if you were sending me an email comment for the guest. So please use this function, and that's good for any of the shows. For example, the show listed for Sunday with Rachel Tillman on the Virtual Viking Museum and the Viking Project, you can already be posting comments on that if you are so inclined to do so. And in addition, once the shows are archived, then that is our blog. So we no longer have a WordPress blog. It's all integrated into the Space Show website. So remember, all of our programs are archived, and you can easily listen to the programs right off of our website or download them. And there is a word of caution. The program from Friday has some sort of a glitch in it and is not podcasting correctly. So we're trying to figure out why the podcasting services do not like it. Maybe they don't like ISDC. I don't know. But we're working on getting that fixed, and it is not yet fixed. So bear with us on that. And you can download our shows, by the way, very, very quickly if you have high-speed internet. Each show is in the neighborhood of 22 to 25 megabytes. Other things are on the Space Show website. There's a menu up at the upper top with lots of links to interesting, useful, and important things. And then remember, of course, we are a 501c3 nonprofit with one O-N-E, GiantLeapFoundation.org. And your support is what keeps us on the air. So as a 501c3 nonprofit, if you donate and you pay federal U.S. taxes, remember you do get a tax deduction for your gift. And the same is true for those of you that pay California taxes. We're actually a California public benefit corporation. We have new sponsors with our newly designed website. And the first segment of our program today is brought to you by two sponsors. So one of them is Celestis, which is the global premier space memorial service. And their message for today, they have great messages because they're very historical, is the original Celestis. With 14 mentioned space flights to date, Celestis has flown more people in space than all the world's space agencies combined. Of course, they're flying ashes, not people, but anyway, let's forget that for a moment. But did you know that there have been two Celestis companies in the 1980s? A Melbourne, Florida company called the Celestis Group wanted to fly human ashes on board a launch vehicle provided by Space Services Incorporated of America, which conducted the first private launch into space in 1982, though ultimately unsuccessful in launching the company. By proving that people all over the world were interested in Memorial spaceflight, this pioneering effort led to the groundwork for the today's Celestis Incorporated, which was formed in 1994 by two former employees of Space Services Incorporated of America. The experienced professionals at today's Celestis stand ready to help you commemorate the life of a departed loved one or prearrange a memorial spaceflight for yourself. They're at Celestis.com or Celestis.org. Remember, I've been a customer of Celestis with my mom and my two dogs, and they're one of the absolute all-time finest organizations and group of people I have ever had the pleasure to work with. And I would work with them again in a heartbeat. They are fabulous. And then AIAA is also a sponsor of our program. And AIAA has five forums, which are really conferences. They now call their conferences forum. By the way, it is the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics. There are five forums: are SciTech, Defense, Aviation, Propulsion and Energy, and Space. Space 2016 this year is in Long Beach, and I hope to be down there for it. They bring together like-minded aerospace professionals across industry, academia, and government for a blend of engaging plenary sessions, in-depth Forum 360 programs, robust technical programming, and networking opportunities that jumpstart dialogues, discovery, collaborations, and careers. The AIAA members help make the world safer, more connected, more accessible, and more prosperous. And you can get a lot more information about joining them and their event dates and planning and reservations at www.aiaa.org. And for today, I'm really happy to bring back Dr. Madhu Thangavelu, who is going to be probably the first Secretary of Space when his idea takes hold and we establish a Department of Space at a cabinet level. But for right now, he conducts the ASTE 527 Graduate Space Exploration Architectures Concept Synthesis Studio, and this is at USC in the Department of Astronautical Engineering. He holds degrees in engineering and architecture and has contributed extensively to concepts in space architecture, especially dealing with extraterrestrial development. He's written over 70 technical papers in space architecture, as well as numerous articles in space-related trade journals and magazines dealing with space stations, lunar base design, and human factors. His full bio is on the website, and you can read it, and I urge you to read it, but it's a lot more fun to talk to him and to welcome the most likely first secretary of the Department of Space when he gets it organized and sold to the government and the people. Dr. Madhu Thangavelu, and welcome to the show. Are you ready for your government role?
David, I thought we kind of agreed that you would play that role and I would assist you, but it looks like I am the target.
You're the target, and I'm anything but a diplomat, so there's no way that anyone's going to appoint or approve me, but you are a commensurate diplomat, so tell us about the Department of Space and why is it that nobody in the primaries is even talking about the word space?
Before I begin that, thank you. It's been a while since I was on air with you, David. It's always a pleasure. And your introductory note tells us something very nice about the two organizations that play a role in your beautiful new website, and that is Celestis and AIAA. And I want to commend them both because I remember sitting in the Celestis talk. I think, what was his name? Chuck something was
Charlie is the guy who runs it. Is that who you're thinking of?
I don't know about Chuck. Yeah, anyhow, you know, and I commented at that time, finally we have a real business besides SATCOM in space. And it really is true, you know, and I really wish Celestis all the best, because they're doing an incredible. I think Tim Leary and so on were.
Yeah, he was on the Founders flight.
That's right.
He was on the Founders flight with a couple of other people, and you know that's probably higher than he got even on his LSD, right?
Well, that's true. But and then AIAA, what a commendable organization. I mean, you know. You may know that the ASTE program, you know, that is nested within the incredible one and only astronautical engineering program that USC offers. You know, we have constantly fed into the AIAA space conferences with the ideas that we propose in our class. And this year, too, I think we have two or three papers coming in. So they are an incredible organization, you know, on the top list of creative pursuits that our astronautical community engages in. And I'm very, very thankful for all they do for us. Now, having said that, let's get into this department thing. But one more thing before we do that, and that is, hopefully the readership knows that Mercury is transiting the solar disk right now. Did you, David?
Yes, I did. I haven't mentioned it on the air, but I got the NASA releases in it, and I've seen it in the news. So it's happening as we speak, in fact.
Well, just as you have a good sunny day, you know, we are having a little bit of a problem here in the peninsula, Palos Verdes, but I did bring out my binoculars and checked it out. It's important for children particularly to see this apparition, because it tells you how small, how insignificant planets are compared to Mr. Sun, you know. And I hope all of you will take, you know, the transit takes a long time, and it's right now it's past the middle of it, as I recall, but hopefully people go and see it. Anyhow, talking about the Department of Space, David, I don't know where to begin, but I can tell you, sometime during the early parts of NASA, when they started meeting out contracts to the aerospace industry, which was very young then, they first realized, hey, listen, the better way to do this, if we had a Department of Space, then NASA would come to the table like the rest of the commercial world would, and then we could have a discussion about how to spend our monies wisely. And so it's not my invention, David. It's been around for 30 or 40 years, the department.
I wrote about it in my dissertation back in 99 and 2000.
Everybody thinks through this, so it's not a new idea at all. But I think it's an idea for which the time has come. And the reason is, it's not NASA or the science community anymore that plays a role, and a big role at it, that. I think SATCOM industry, you know, did a lot to swerve away from the scientific pursuits that NASA engages in, you know. And that is happening. And now, Why would we bring this up again at this time? Only because it's an election year, David. That's a no-brainer, right?
Well, except that in the primaries, nobody's even mentioned the word space.
Why do you think that is? Is it because it's not a priority?
Yeah,
or is it just plain neglect?
No, David.
I have an answer.
I think it's not a priority, and it's a killer, and there's no need for them to bring it up. Because, remember, in the primaries, they're trying to convince their party base that they should be their party's candidate for president. Now, will it come up in the general election? Maybe in a space state, if the electoral votes are considered important, Florida, for example, because their space economy has actually been recovering, and they have a lot riding on a continued growing space economy, both from NASA and the private sector. Texas, maybe. California has long ago turned its back on aerospace for some reason, so I don't think it will have any effect in California. It might in Colorado and some of the other states, but I think it's a non-winner for the candidates because the public is not demanding it. You know, when they poll space, it's usually down around 25 or 28 of items that people care about. They care about jobs. They care about the economy. They care about, you know, terrorism and security, you know, that kind of thing. They care about, you know, borders or whatever. You want to go down the list. You can go down the list as well as I can. So I think it just doesn't sell.
Well, I think the time is here when the administration start to realize that NASA cannot be on a short leash, with the State Department. And the reason is, space is too important for the world community, David. And to me, if I looked at all the primaries, at least what we saw, was just terrible during the primaries, particularly the GOP side. They never mentioned it in Texas. Cruz didn't. Trump didn't. In Florida, they didn't. And these are all space economies. I mean, they do a lot of space things there. And space organizes the workforce there. You know, we have some of the most visionary people who reside in those parts. I mean, we hopefully this talk today will lead candidates to talk about space when they arrive in California, David.
Well, they have issued space statements. So Air America, which is an AIAA publication, has produced an article, and it's on our Space Shell blog on one of the recent shows. A listener sent it to me, where they interviewed the candidates about space. And let's see, Hillary did not comment, but they know a little bit about her positions from past comments. Kasich, who's no longer in the show, issued a statement about space. Trump did the interview. Sanders did the interview. I think Cruz did the interview. He was still in at the time. So we do know something about their positions on space. In the past, Ben Carson had said things about space. So had Rubio had said a few things coming from Florida, and so had Jeb Bush. I think it's not what the people want to talk about and what their issues are. When they do the exit polls of both Democrats as well as Republicans voting in the primary, what are they interested in? They're interested in jobs, they're interested in the economy, and they're interested in security.
And you remember the brouhaha when Newt Gingrich talked about moon colony, remember?
Well, yeah, but blew it. I mean, he made such a stupid statement.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, if the messenger of such topics is the right person, David, and coming at the right time, I think it will really resonate with the American people. After all, we are the premier nation that leads people out into
space. So who's the right messenger? They're certainly not running for office.
Well, there you go. That's another angle to look at it. But, you know, come on, let's all be optimistic, David.
Well, but who's let's go beyond the who's the right messenger to put this into the campaign?
Yeah, it's a good question. But that'll require the next hour in a different discussion, I suppose.
I think the priorities are such that even if space came up in the campaign, it'd be so way down it wouldn't be one of the issues that commanded who or what to vote for. But if you look at what happened when Obama got elected the first time around, so remember, space was not a big issue at all, and he had made some pretty crazy statements about taking space money and putting it into fifth grade education or something like that. And then, you know, the space lobbyists, for lack of a better word, got to him, and all of that was changed. But what did happen is he did get people involved that had come out of that NSS and Air Force Space Solar Power study back in 2006, 2007. And they got into positions in NASA and elsewhere. You had George Whitesides, for example, and Charles Miller and a couple of other people. And they had the ear of the White House for commercial space, and they were able to really work a lot of the changes in favor of commercial space into the space program once the president got into office. So I think maybe the key for what you're talking about comes from within the newly elected president's organization, if key people can get into appointed positions. And I think that's really critical.
I agree with many of the things you say, but, you know, specifically looking at the last 8 years of the Obama administration, you know, I like a lot of things about parties that that we have we've had you know, opposing views on. But let me tell you, any smart man would have done what our president did, and that is, he would look at NASA as an instrument of policy, both domestic and international, and take advantage of it. And that's what politicians and people in power do. They have very little time or bearing on what to do next and so on. And here comes the president, and he's endowed with the International Space Station. So what does he do? He gets people in line, hundreds of people in line, to utilize the space station. And I think they've done a commendable job in these last 8 years, you know, putting International Space Station as the crown jewel in the NASA space program. And it's done very, very well, David. But the question I ask is, what next? That's where we all tend to disagree and say, oh, what is the next vision? And I'm afraid to tell you, it's in that area, and NASA has been bankrupt these last 8 years. You know, we talk about going to asteroids and Mars and so on. Absolutely nothing came of it. I mean, you know, I don't mean to knock anybody, but listen, the agency has always been about flying daring missions.
Not anymore.
You know, see, this is very sad, you know, and we need to bring that up. And that is why I really think now is the time for a department to get in there and do something. You know, when you saw that article, I mean, you read it, and everybody I know, in fact, including some parts of myself, go like, wait a minute, we don't want any crappy government in there. I mean, that's our first knee-jerk reaction.
Absolutely.
And I can understand that, you know, because they drag us through coals for every little thing you want to do, and governments have, most importantly, they have better things to do. But, you know, when you probe it a little deeper, David, the United States government evolved from other great democratic governments and processes, stand the best chance of executing complex programs and projects like space needs than any other government that I can think of. And to those who think we don't need governments, I just laugh at them, you know, because the culture of America, the way we talk, the way we act, the way we breathe, I mean, everything about us, American, is really because of governance. And governance and business play a give-and-take role in how society is developed, David. So to just poo-poo and say, oh, no, we don't want governments, we don't want any more layers of bureaucracy and so on, that is childish. I mean, it's ludicrous.
Madhu, how does one go about getting a new cabinet-level department? So we all remember, you know, the Department of Homeland Security, which was actually a merger of other organizations and a little bit new. And as I recall, all of that had to be approved by Congress in special legislation and everything. So what does somebody in the House or the Senate have to propose a bill for a Department of Space and get it through both houses of Congress and then the president signs it? Is that how you create a new cabinet office? I don't know the answer to that.
Well, you know, I'm asking you, but we are all in it together, David. But, you know, I'm glad you brought up the idea about you know, the Department of Homeland Security and how quickly it gelled.
overnight, right?
That's right. I mean, because it was a necessity. It became a critical national security issue. Now, can we expect space to become such an issue overnight? Again, I'm thinking the time is ripe for this, David. And why I say that is because we are not the only nation anymore that wants to fly missions to the moon and Mars and to other places. There are already rocket ships waiting on the launch pad in other countries going to those places. Now, then the question becomes, is it somehow eroding the lifeblood of our commerce? The answer, David, to me is yes. It is already doing that. It has been doing that since the time the State Department put the clamps on the ITAR and MTCR came on board, and we could not do business globally. And, it's not going to get any better because there are new technologies out there that can build these things for a fraction of the cost that nations used. The reason they called it a monopoly had to do with all those regimes and, export of weaponry and so on and so forth. All of that is going into the background, David. I mean, it's fading away. And there is a new pressure out there to do things in space, not only for strict commercial reasons, which, again, the U.S. leads in for now. And that's going to go away because everybody else is going to get on the bandwagon. So for those reasons, it falls plump in the middle of national security, because I think commerce is the lifeblood of national security. I mean, they can say all that they want about all the other things and how we preserve certain, DOD and so on for national security. But at the bottom end, it's very clear commerce plays the biggest role, and we had better quickly get a department going that'll bring the agency, that'll bring the private sector, and not only that, we need to bring global partners into the picture, David. And we've done that before. And I think we can do that again. This is the nation that built the Panama Canal, David. I mean, you go in there, make a country, and build the canal. We can do that. And I'm sure we are doing that now in different ways.
Keep in mind, we're also the nation that sold it to China.
See, now this is what we hear from the Wall Street Journal these days. But, there's more to it than all that, the U.S. is different. I mean, could it be that we are biased? But I think the U.S. is different, David, because we are a global society. China is always accused of being a regional player, just as Russia is. And there's a reason they have their structures. Again, it falls in the jurisdiction of governance. How do you govern? I think the U.S. has the best chance to do something like a Department of Space.
Here, I have a question from you from a listener. Okay.
Oh, gosh, I'm in trouble already. Okay.
Yeah, you are. So Harry's in Austin, Texas, and he said, what would be your actual compelling reasons to convince a president or Congress to create a cabinet-level Department of Space? What would be your top two or three reasons?
Well, the first chart that I think Congress will understand is that the cost of production of many of the items are falling so rapidly, and the technologies have evolved not just in the U.S. but all over the world in such a way. India can produce a launcher at 10% of the cost or 20% of the cost of our best private sector, and so this is happening. China can do the same. So then the question becomes: are we going to just wait till we take this very special, homegrown, advanced technology industry and let it decay and die and run away to other parts of the world? I mean, I'll put up a chart up front, the first chart to Congress or to Terry, or to other people would be, hey, listen, this is the cost of production of such and such a complex space system. Now, if I were to go do this in India, I can do it for this price. Now, can we not do better? Can we not get creative and start turning the heat on a homegrown industry that is waiting in the wing, David, and do something with it before somebody else eats our lunch? And that's my first thing that I would say, not to mention, I know you and I are biased, David, but the fact still remains, NASA is an icon. You know, it's an apple in the eye for the whole world dreaming about space. So I'm going to say, hey, listen, if you want to be the leader of the free world, if we want to continue to create visions that aspire to the highest ideals of humanity, space is right there on top, you know. I mean, there are other things we could do, too, but, you know, this is an important area.
So what would number two be?
Number two is, I said, the vision of global space activity. And, you know, I am a believer in cosmopolitan. Do you know that term, cosmopolitanism, David? It's a thinking. I think President Obama put that also during his Cairo speech. The idea is that, you know, we don't have to go around the world building nations and, you know, policing and so on, if we did something else, and that is something like making people aspire for a better future. And space really, truly plays a role in that area, David. And that would be my second clear signal. Hold up the torch of vision. You know, it is something that the presidents before, the founding fathers before, have talked about. And they didn't just do that just to show off. You know, the term that we always use, the shining city upon a hill. I mean, seriously, right now we got a city on a hill that's looking around for who's going to pay the electrical bills. I mean, seriously, that's not the United States that the world knows and the world wants. You know, the world is looking up to the U.S. for what is the next dimension in human activity. And space is right up there, ever ready and to go. Yeah.
So the third one would be it's a way to pay the electric bills?
Well, you know, my thinking is departments are formed when needs arise, like Homeland Security.
Right.
But also they form when they see an opportunity, David. And, you know, when you look at Homeland Security, it was done because it was a national security need. But you know what? It's now a huge industry. There's a whole private industry around it. And so when you look at commerce, the third important thing that comes to mind is, listen, here are beautiful groups of small companies doing incredible things. You know, SpaceX is not small anymore, but it used to be very tiny just a few years ago. And there are companies like Made in Space and, the resources, planetary resources. I mean, these are all small companies waiting in the wing to take off. And the moment you have a larger entity overseeing the funds and bringing together various groups like the FAA and so on into the mix, oh, there's going to be so much more ease in the way you can discuss and debate what's the best way to go forward. And no one's going to sit on $20 billion and say, oh, you write me a proposal and we'll see if it works. And then it goes around, bounces around, and so on. It's going to be much smoother. That's my thinking, David.
Well, do you think that this should come up in the election or wait until a new administration is sworn in?
Oh, your thinking is the same as mine. I mean, this should have come in 20 years ago. I think creative governments and creative far-thinking visionary administrations will seize on this opportunity. And now, more than before, especially because the private sector has shown they can do things quicker and more efficiently, and they can get the job done, without on schedule, on time. And, you know, I think all of us know what SpaceX has done in the last couple of attempts to land and reuse the rockets. And in my thinking, when I see that, I'm going like, why did NASA not do this 40 years ago? Simply because it is not part of their charter, David. It is not part of the charter. The agency was used as a tool right from the start, get-go, to show our supremacy in defense and so on. The world has moved. The world has changed. Just as the demography of the United States has changed, and so we have to move with the times, and we have to fine tune and tweak our vision with the times. What's wrong with that?
Nothing. I think it's a superhuman task to do this.
And that's a good term you use, you know. And you must remember this too. I was listening to, I think it was Neil deGrasse Tyson questioning somebody in the UK, and he goes like, why is it that Europe does not have superheroes? You know, why is it that the Superman, Batman, and Green Lantern and Flash come out of the United States? And the reason is simple. There are a select group of people among us who are really superhuman, and they can do it. The reason I go into class and lecture is because I know that somebody somewhere at some time in some galaxy will listen and say, hey, we can do this. I just will forget sleep for the next 2 months. I'm going to get this done. You know, there are people out there who can do it in this great United States of America, David.
No, I agree. I think it's just it's hard to get that going. So, and here's a listener comment more than a question that evidences this. So this is from Bob, and Bob is in San Diego, and he says, sorry, I'm at work, so I can't use the phone. But many of us who are commercial space supporters, and especially coming at this from the entrepreneurial community and the new space side, would absolutely rebel against the Department of Space for the reasons you said earlier about putting more government into space itself. What we need is less government and more private sector involvement along the lines of what is happening right now. I think a Department of Space would just make this such a big political bureaucracy, it would be worse than what we have now.
See, you know, I think with all due respect, again to Bob
is his name.
Again to Bob, I want to bring your attention and focus it very carefully on governance. On governance, what does it mean, governance? It's not a bunch of guys sitting in a whole line and stamping papers and saying yes, yes, or no, no, and getting paid a salary, monthly salary for pushing paper. Governance is the reason, as I mentioned, why we in America live the lives we live in America today. And governance, good governance, goes with good commerce. Just as the philosophy of good governance creates vision, private sector can then hook on to these very large visions about, be it space solar power, space-based solar power, or planetary defense, or very large commercial enterprises dealing with developing the space economic infrastructure, like what Planetary Resources is doing. I wouldn't say it is inevitable for governments to play a role, but it's very, very critical. If you look at any large operation that was undertaken by humanity and by society, I mean, very rich people were made, but they were made because of very, very visionary and clear-thinking governance at the highest levels. And all you need to do is go look at the history, and not to mention, look at how budgets are made available to make very large endeavors happen. And, you know, space still falls under that category. And, you know, I'm not... I'm not very much into seeing how various departments play a role, but I do know very clearly that when pandemics strike, or even before they strike, departments play a role in mobilizing resources towards those kinds of areas and actions to take care of things before things go awry. And, you know, let me bring up this point for Bob. What happened when there was no regulation and banks went on a ride a couple of years back? I mean, I know there'll be still debates about what really went on, but there was a little feeling that if we just let them run with it, everything would be fine, and we'll just see us boost our profits, and everybody is going to be, you know, we'll all be in Camelot. It didn't quite work that way, David. And so that's why I think governance is important. But I know there'll be a lot of arrows coming at me and others who propose that, because governors and governance can be terrible sometimes, in fact, most of the time. So the idea is not to shun government, but to seek out good governance, you know, and say, what is the optimal governance? I think you can look at some historical examples in other parts of the world. I think there was incredibly good governance during the Second World War. In the UK, there was Tizard and group working on the radar. In the U.S., there was incredible governance with the Manhattan Project. These are things that commerce cannot do by themselves. You know, they need to be charged with actions like that. And and when certain budgets get to certain levels of operational budgets, you can't handle that through sitting together at a table and between commercial entities. You need government. I mean, it's obvious. I mean, you know, that's my answer to Bob. I know he doesn't like me, but that's the way it is.
Okay. we'll take this question, then we'll go to Brett
okay.
Because we're halfway through.
Okay.
So Carol of St. Louis says, do you envision this Department of State to say, we're going to go to Mars? No, we're going to go to the moon. No, we're going to go do an asteroid or do something like that. Would this Department of State say no to reusability? Would it say no or yes to building a super-duper rocket like SLS? What would this department actually do?
Is that Carol? Is that her name?
Yeah, her name is Carol in St. Louis.
Okay, you know, Carol is playing the devil. She's advocating the devil here, and I appreciate that. You know, what she mentioned are all very good examples of very bad governance and a very bad department that should be dismantled immediately.
Why is that? I would envision that's what the department would be doing too.
Well, you know, regulatory issues come into play. You know, now there is in aviation, there is a federal aviation agency, and you know, if we had just let commercial entities fly their routes from the time of Howard Hughes and, you know, what was it, one, and so on. Do you think we'd be here the way we are, is safe, reliable, and talked about industry in aviation? I doubt it. I really doubt it, because even during the growth of the aviation industry, there were pointers which said, no, we need somebody to regulate this. And FAA was born, the ICAO was born, and guess what? All of that really helped to structure a growing and vibrant aviation industry. My thinking is there are good side and bad sides to governance, and in general, engineers, including yours truly, hate it when bureaucrats in their regular attire walk in and say, "Hey, what's going on? It's none of your business, seriously." I mean, you know, when we are doing when we are doing creative pursuits, the last thing you want there is to fill out 27 different forms, followed by 30 volumes of material that nobody ever reads, and so on and so forth. So, it's a quest more than anything else for a way to make things happen quickly, to make very large projects happen quickly, David.
So in terms, though, of the policy that Carol was talking about, would this department have the say-so on going to Mars, or would that still be, say, a NASA venture or a NASA public-private partnership or something?
Oh, Carol is putting me in the spot there, and you two are. But let me tell you, my own thinking is wait till SpaceX announces that they're going to fly to Mars by themselves. I mean, you know, and, you know, we are there. We are in that that area, the arena now, where private space vehicles are being readied by Elon's team, and not to mention hot on his heels are Amazon guru with Blue Origin, and there are several others who think they can do this without all the bureaucracy of governance. So specifically about Mars, my thinking is, even though a lot of people will disagree with me, I think a private Mars mission is viable. It's viable, and you don't have to go to faster propulsion technologies and so on. We can do this. And if I remember right, I think it was General Worden with that team from Paragon, who talked about doing a flight around Mars. You recall? What did they call it? Inspiration Mars.
Inspiration Mars.
Yeah, that's right. And so it won't be long before we dethrone the national status of missions like these, and can-do companies, perhaps not even multinationals, can-do companies supported by eccentric billionaires might just do it.
but I'm going to go back to my question. Would the Department of State be able to say to SpaceX, you can't do this? Would they say, we're going to go to Phobos and Deimos and not Mars? This is what, do they have that authority?
Well,
is that their role?
Think about it right now, and this is to Carol too. Think about it. Who says that now? The people who say that are the Department of State and the administration. They are the people you can't do this. You can't
nobody,
do that.
Well,
you can't do
nobody's
that.
Nobody's really saying that yet, because nobody can go do it yet. But NASA says they have a roadmap to go to Mars. Would a Department of Space overrule that? Let's just assume their roadmap to Mars is real and realistic. Or let's say Mars One could actually fly higher than a Southwest Airlines plane and go to Mars. Would a Department of State say, we're not going to allow you to go to Mars? You know, we don't want that. You do something else. I mean, is that what you're looking for out of the government, is a policy maker or a policy preventer?
No, I wasn't thinking policy in that direction, David, because I was thinking more in terms of pulling synergies together from various departments and trying to bring, just like Homeland Security did after the calamity, the terrible tragedy. My thinking was that already there are several departments, you know, like the Department of Transportation, Department of Energy, and they already work with NASA as the nexus for all of these operations. I'm thinking a Department of Space would be impartial. An impartial regulator of all space activity, and they will look for synergies within departments without the agency globally. And all of these things are happening in small ways within NASA right now. So if you remember, one of the things I asked in my article was, is it appropriate for NASA, with such a constrained and specific charter, to engage in those kinds of actions, or is it better for a department to do that? And that's why I led us to believe that a department would be better. And will the department push policies against growth? That would be poison. That would surely be not the charter of the department that I envisioned, David. And that's not what, if you remember right, this whole thing started taking shape at USC in 2011. I think you sat in review, did you, David?
No, I didn't participate in that.
Oh, great. Buzz Aldrin was on the review panel then.
No, I remember. You always do this on nights I do a space show program, so I've never participated.
And you keep excusing yourself all the time.
Well,
but I'm
going
to catch you one of these days.
You need to do it on a night other than Tuesday.
Well, anyhow, Buzz was there. And he had also talked about the Department of Space many years before then, I suppose. And when we talked about it, we started to look at, let's assume even if all the engineers and private space sector beat up on us, let's assume that there is a department. What would it be? How much would it be? How big would it be? And so on. And they can look over those slides to give you an idea about what it is that the department would do, but to think that we would raise policies that put brakes on private space sector or global synergies would be the exact opposite of how we dreamt up the USC's Department of Space set of slides.
All right, we're going to take our pause. We're a little beyond halfway, and listeners, we'll be gone for about 3 minutes, so please don't go anywhere. We'd like to hear from you via the telephone, if you can, and it is 1-866-687-7223, and of course, the email address remains the same, drspace@thespaceshow.com, and everybody, we will be back in 3 minutes.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with The Space Show. Your support of The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support the Space Show button. Your contribution will help the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to the Space Show is tax deductible.
The mission of the Space Show is to promote future economic opportunities, scientific discoveries, and medical advances for all humankind through peaceful and cooperative ventures in outer space. The Space Show intends to be the forum by which space exploration becomes an integral part of our culture, our economy, our country, our world, and our global vision, in which all nations unite in creating a thriving future through the enormous potentials afforded by off-Earth opportunities. The Space Show is committed to advancing integrity and responsibility, both in our off-Earth conduct and in the potential long-range consequences of our actions in space. The Space Show wants to make the dreams of space today the realities of tomorrow.
And welcome back, everybody. Part two of our Monday Space Show program. We're talking about the possible creation of a Department of Space, a cabinet-level Department of Space. Our guest, Professor Madhu Thangavelu. And we have two sponsors for this part of our program. One of the sponsors is the Integrated Space Plan put out by the Integrated Space Analytics Company. This is a highly detailed development chart of how we become a truly spacefaring race, see how technologies and destinations build upon each other, and explore each of the hundreds of individual elements in their plan, which is on their website, thespaceplan.com. And if you're at ISDC on Thursday, May 19th, there is an Integrated Space Plan program on the agenda that you probably want to attend. And principals Jay Whitner, Ron Jones, and Gary Bickberg will be there presenting the Integrated Space Plan policy and activities. And, of course, it's open for everyone who is at ISDC 2016 in San Juan, Puerto Rico. The Integrated Space Plan is useful and an inspiring tool that should be on the wall of everyone serious about space development. Again, check them out at thespaceplan.com. And Orbital ATK is a sponsor, and they've got another five-segment booster test coming up. And I believe it's scheduled for June, and people can go. You can probably see their press announcement on their website. But I've seen them, and they are great. Good, good experience. You have to do a little bit of traveling to get to Promontory, Utah, but it's worth it. Great people in Utah, too. Orbital ATK is a global leader in aerospace and defense technology. They are the partner you can count on for advanced, reliable space propulsion systems for space exploration, commercial ventures, and defense programs. Again, Orbital ATK. If you can do the five-segment booster trip to Promontory, Utah, I really recommend it, and I want to hear from you. Of course, it's also shown on the Internet, and you get a better seat on the Internet, but the ambiance is really outrageous, and I promise you, you will love having gone to it. Have you ever been up there to see any of the rocket tests, Madhu?
Well, not the HTPB lighter, but we've seen the shuttle launch, so I know how it feels like, you know. And you know.
Yeah, that's better than the five-segment booster test for sure.
when you listen to all the things you said, it reminded me of good old Ron Jones. I was just a student at that time. In fact, I graduated and ended up at Rockwell in Downey.
Well, that's where he was.
And so I ran into this man. So he says, Madhu, let's go have some tea or something like that. So we go out of the facility and go there, and he pulls out this huge plan.
Yeah, that's it. He's the father of it. Yeah, he created it 20
that's
years ago.
That's Ron's work, yes. Yeah. I remember him very well. And there were lots of other people who wanted ownership and so on. He had to fight and keep it going. And I'm glad to know that Ron will be at ISDC. Are you going?
No, I'm not going. Are you planning to be there?
No. Bob Crone wanted me there. I don't think I can do this. Though at one time, I always dreamt that I would go on the Arecibo dish and ski down, you know.
I don't think they let you do that, Madhu.
Okay, well, anyhow, so that's that. And you mentioned something else, too. See, this ATK thing, if you remember, Dr. Griffin was administrator.
Right.
And he had this concept for the stick, you know, remember?
Right.
The idea to fly, and they got to fly it, too.
Right.
And so, you know, those were, in my opinion, the beginning signs of a cost-conscious and sustainable, you know, endeavor from the agency. But then it became a thing called Liberty Rocket and so on. And I don't know where they stand, David, but that's for another talk.
I think it kind of petered out. I don't think it went any place. I guess they could resurrect it if there was interest, but I don't think there's interest.
And for those listeners who need to know, it'll be very interesting for them all to know that there are some very basic, fundamental physical differences between lighting an SRB booster or one of those HTPB stacked solid boosters versus liquid propulsion. David, do you know what that is?
Well, their burn is completely different, and
that's right.
Their burn
is completely different.
Completely different.
The way you engage the burn is one is on the top side, in the other, the liquid engines affect their energies right at the engines, you know, but not the case with boosters. It's a very fascinating.
Yeah, it
way.
Just
so
burns
it affects
through
the flight dynamics because. That plays a role, yeah.
Right, and it just burns through that solid fuel core, and it just,
that's right.
It
not
just
to
keeps
mention,
burning.
It burns rough, David, and that's why they say that you know the early part of the shuttle mission, the first 2 minutes, it's really like a buckaroo, right?
I mean, it vibrates.
It shakes and shivers to no end. But then when you talk to the Apollo astronauts, they say, "Oh, that's nothing." Compared to Saturn during the early parts of the launch, too. Well, anyhow, so shall we get back to a little bit more about the department and then go on to other things, David?
Go ahead.
See, now, one of the things I wanted to impress on our viewership or readership, which brings me to the point, maybe one of these days the space show will become a video show, David?
Well, we from time to time do videos and webinars, but what's on your mind?
I'm thinking our talks should go on, be videos so that I can show models and images and visuals and so on that make it more exciting, perhaps.
They have to be professionally engineered, so yes, we could do a webinar together. I mean, I don't have a problem with that. And if you want to plan that for, say, the next time we do a show, and I need to get my engineer up here to do it. But, yeah, we could do that.
Oh, great. Okay, good. So, anyhow, let's get back to this Department of Space thing a little more. Now, David, do you know how big the world economies are? Amid all the shouting and the trillions of dollars going down the tube and so on and so on and so forth, do you know how big the world economies are?
Combined together?
No, just by the great nations who seem to have a clout.
Well, we're probably, what, around $10 or $11 trillion, the United States?
Well, Google it, David. The U.S. is at $17.5 trillion.
And China's about 10, then.
10.
Yeah.
Japan is 5. Germany is 4, France and UK are, you know, 3 and 2.5, India, Russia, they're all coming up very fast. They're all $2 trillion economies or more. And then, so when we proposed, and you know what the U.S. budget outlays for 2017, right?
Right.
About $4 trillion. So now we're going like, wait a minute, we got $4 trillion. There are new advanced technologies coming online. Robotics is one area of interesting. Biotech is blooming. You're going like, Can we not spend out of $4 trillion, can we not rearrange the chairs at least between departments and so on to create synergies for a $60 billion outlay for a department of space? Now, many of them, when they hear this, will either swoon or take a swing at me, you know, but that's okay. But the fact remains, I think, that if you want to grow a healthy space program that is really a homegrown asset, which won't be in 10 years' time, if we have the first mover advantage now, I think we have to cash in. And, you know, NASA is going to head up with about $20 billion pretty soon. And I'm thinking if we have $20 billion for private sector and another $20 billion for what we call global projects, a total of $60 billion will put us right on the driver's seat, David, right in the driver's seat for a very vibrant space program. Our children deserve that, David, because, you know, there's only so many solar panels we can install on rooftops. There's only so much music we can create. You know, we need an escape from what I like to think is a zero-sum game in energies and resources and so on. And space is just waiting for that to happen. So is $60 billion too much to ask?
Well, where are you going to take it from?
Good question. You know, those are the things that I would like the administration, the coming administration, to think about. Visionary ideas about how to light a fire under and nurture visionary technology.
Okay, so Madhu, for 2016, the deficit is estimated to be $616 billion. Okay, so that's the difference between what we spend and what we take in. And the only way we take in money is through taxes from you, because you happen to have a salary and you earn money. And the rest of it, you know, we don't have businesses in the U.S. that you know, make profits for the U.S. You know, we collect tax revenue. So this is all coming in on tax revenue. So we're running a $20 trillion national debt, and we've got a deficit of $616 billion estimated for 2016, and you want to spend $60 billion in the new organized Department of Space. And so where do you take it from? We're not in balance. We don't have a balanced budget by any means. And now, wait a minute. I'm not through giving you all the good news. So I don't know what category a cabinet-level Department of Space would be in. I'm clueless there. But NASA is in the discretionary part of the budget. So that means it is a very junior partner to all those items that are not discretionary, including our wonderful entitlements, a lot of the Defense Department programs, and the servicing of the $20 trillion national debt, which we are able to do because interest rates are so damn low. But if interest rates were to go to probably market interest rates, we wouldn't have any money left for anything, because the debt service, you know, as long as we didn't default on our debt, would probably take up most of everything the U.S. has. So how do you, I mean, if you're in charge of how you're going to allocate resources, what are you going to do? You can't touch
entitlements. You can't touch entitlements. Thank you for pouring cold water on my face, David, and waking me up. But let me tell you something.
No, I mean, there might be a way. I don't know it. I'm not skilled in this area. I can run these numbers and look at the problem, but I'm not the guy who knows how to jiggle the books and figure out how to do it.
Yeah, you know, I think this is something that needs careful attention. And, you know, and I think there are ways out, and there are openings in many, many creative ways. I wish I had a degree in governance and in the way the United States government works.
You'd be a crook then. You'd be a crook then, and now now you're an honest person.
But you know what? More and more, I think it's an interesting area to explore. But let me ask you something, and you probably know the answer to this, David.
Okay.
You know, the United States is fighting wars in foreign lands.
Right.
In the last couple of years, we have shifted in some ways about how and where the resources come to fight these battles. Now, yes, we are able to pull in international partners and provide them a credible plan. Do you think that this budget that we talk about for a Department of Space will be completely funded by what we, you know, between discretionary funding? I mean, that is a joke. Nobody does anything like this through discretionary funding, David. You know, if you look at departments, a lot of the money goes towards mandatory spending. And, I think NASA still is part of the housing and urban development connection there. I quite remember. But the way they appropriate funds is not very straightforward. I mean, nothing is straightforward. But my thinking is that we should not pull this into a subset of the Treasury or the budget and say, oh, we are really stretching the discretionary budget. No, you know, Department of Space cannot exist, in my opinion, on just asking for more discretionary spending. It has to come from someplace else. And my thinking is if we grow and show credibility in global growth of the space program into projects that mean not just just something for the U.S., but for the whole world. A particular example in question is planetary defense, David. If we can really show that there is a credible system that we can evolve, I think it'll be very, very quickly we'll fill the coffers for the Department of State.
Well, I just found, and I don't think this is the entire budget, but the President's fiscal year 2017 budget provides $50.1 billion in discretionary funding for this Department of State and for the U.S. Agency for International Development, including $15 billion in overseas contingency operations. I don't think 100% of the State Department is discretionary funding, but I don't know. But they're getting $50.1 billion in discretionary funding.
You know, and the reason I remember when we were looking at the various budgets way back in 2011, and we came up with this number, $50 billion or $60 billion, we were going like, and that doesn't look like the funding for an agency. That looks like a funding for a department. So that was kind of the corollary reasoning, you know. How do you manage $60 billion? You'd have a department, you know. Now, take the Defense Department. I think it runs in about $600 billion or $700 billion. How do they run it? They have different secretaries for the different wings of the of the defense, you know. And so we see that kind of an organic structure, David, where there is a group, there's probably going to be a secretary for international space, there's going to be a secretary for civil private space, and perhaps and all sitting at the table with the NASA administrator. That's how we envisioned it.
Well, I think you'd have a hard time coming up with the. Remember, Congress would have to allocate that $60 billion.
That's right. So Congress will have to. So, Congress will have to become aware of 21st century technologies and the need to engage our children in that kind of a new world, David. And that's how we push. That's how we that's how we dream. That's how we push to make things happen, you know. So, talking about this particular area, in fact, our last discussion, David, am I right to think we talked about planetary defense? I think we did, didn't we? About the International Space University, and we had...
The summer session.
That's right. That's when I was here. Has it been a year?
Yes, uh-huh.
That's right. Okay, so now I want to bring up something about some ideas that we are floating around. Do you know that is General Walton going to come and talk to you about this incredible thing called Breakthrough Starshot?
I'm asking him. I do not have a reply yet.
Oh, I'll find a few wonderful people who can talk about this, particularly Professor Philip Lubin. You need to get him on there because he is the guy who wrote the proposal.
Do you know him?
Do you know him?
No, I don't. Do you know him?
Oh, yes, indeed. In fact, we exchange emails all the time, including today.
Introduce me and make the case, and I'd be happy to put him on the show.
Oh, wonderful. Okay, good. So now, this, lasers, David, the laser technologies have come a long way. In fact, today's popular mechanics says that we're going to have a couple of C-17s readied up with airborne lasers. And you know what? What they do is something that is out of the science fiction. At least it was in the science fiction till the turn of the last century. And now in this new century, lo and behold, these things are real, David. What I mean is that lasers can take out anything that flies that is in line of sight.
Sure.
And what I'm talking about is that many of these put together can be used for tackling objects in space and threatening objects in space. So that is a technology that is happening right now. It's going to change the entire way we fight wars, David. And I have a hunch that nuclear warfare will very quickly be obsolete because you won't be able to fly a thing or deliver a payload because you'll fry them long before it gets to the target. And I bring this up because planetary defense is an area where we can seek global consensus and global leadership, David, because we can say that we have access to the technologies that can prevent a disaster or prevent a potential disaster, and we can engage the entire global community in that kind of an endeavor. Now, just talking about space, the good work that that NASA Ames is doing, the space portal.
Right.
Have you had somebody come in from there?
Yeah, many times.
Right. And, so we know that, the idea of an international lunar park is an incredibly enticing area for everybody to engage in. And even closer to home, I think it's high time for the International Space Station to be a self-sustaining entity, David. Not a NASA program, but completely funded by the various nations and perhaps run by a space station entity. I mean, it is an international entity that runs space station. So those are three areas in which I think a Department of Space can immediately play a role, not to mention that the department can nurture small companies much better, and allow them to fail much more and without serious ramifications for the entrepreneur if you have a separate Department of Space. So these are some of the thoughts. And shall we move on to some other topics? Any other questions?
I have one more question on the Department of Space from Alexander in New York City. And he says, I'm still not sure how you build support for this and get it to be actively considered. Do you have a plan of action?
Well, you know, we always have to do that. The way we engage is through representation and through the electorate. It has to come about from a change that Congress decides is of value, useful, and urgent. Because many times we miss the boat on new technologies, and the result is that we get left behind. You know, science and technology waits for no one. I think it was Edward Teller who mentioned to us very clearly, there is one quality about science, and that is it doesn't stop running. And, you may take issue with him on many other topics, but I think he has some cute quotes from time to time. How are the ways we can make this happen? I want the listenership, the readership of these things we put out to also put their minds to it. I'm sure there are people within the Office of Budget Management and Budget who have very clear ideas on how it could be done. I'm sure that there are people within the agency who think it can be done, and surely people in the private industry who are well-heeled in governance and how the government of the United States is better for pushing new departments like this into the forefront. I'm sure there are people like that who can help orchestrate that. But the key again remains in our kind of governance, and in our kind of government, the President of the United States, I wouldn't say must be pushed, but the President of the United States should have the vision, even in hindsight, that though we know that past presidents have been pushed very hard to support some space projects, I think the President of the United States must put his or her foot down and say, no, we cannot let this go. This is a homegrown, private enterprise. Nobody else in the world has a private space company that launches rockets to the International Space Station, David. Am I right or wrong?
No, you're correct. So you think this has to come from the president down?
I really do think so, because there are just too many obstacles and too many naysayers in our system, which is a good thing. You know, that's what we call our system one of checks and balances. But there must be at the top a statesman, a visionary, that's what I like to call such a president, a visionary president, who says, enough is enough, all the naysayers can go back home, we are going to do this, I think you've read enough about JFK to know that, he was not very interested in the space program, but the surrounding circumstances were such that he just said, we are going to do this damn thing, and we're going to do it. We're going to do it right. We're going to take people to the moon, like your One Giant Leap says. We did that, came back, and did it over and over. And so once was not enough, it's a terrible shame that circumstances then changed. World history dictated other things happened, and so we forgot. But again, I can't think of any other nation in this time period that we are in now, who can take on superhuman things like this, David. And there are times when we think, and you and I, we have talked about this many times, we say, oh, gosh, it's time to get out of here, go to Canada or someplace. And they're going like, wait a minute. You go to the airport and say, where do I go to now? I don't think there is another country that can do the things we wish and dream about better than here, David. Despite all the misgivings and all the terrible things we throw at each other, I think the United States is a beacon, and we should really be proud to be among a lot of these superhumans. Yeah.
You have a tall order before you.
Oh, that's being understated. I know, but I think, you know, there are things, and almost always, when you propose an idea, rather than execute it for what it is, have you noticed that ideas morph and merge and collude and become something else and so on, and, you know, that's how we try to contribute to discussion that can cause some changes to happen, and hope the Department of Space stays in the minds of our leaders, and hope things happen to accelerate and encourage our youth to do things to create new horizons for themselves and so on.
Madhu, let me quickly change since we're coming up on the end of the show. You recently gave a talk at Chapman in Orange County, California, which I know really well. My son went to film school there, and I actually attended Chapman my sophomore year of school before going to Arizona. But you lectured on 3D printing of food becoming a reality. Tell us about that.
Ooh, this is right. You know, there is a food science department at Chapman U. Did you know that?
Yes, I did know that.
Oh, great.
It's
so, you know,
actually,
there are not very many food science departments in very many universities that I know of, David. So
it's an outstanding university.
Years,
yeah.
Yeah, you know, one of our students wanted to do a team project, like, you know, a mini project that we do at midterms.
Uh-huh.
And at that time, I was involved with the NASA NEAC project dealing with 3D printing. And as you know, the guru for a particular type of 3D printing called contour crafting, Google that, contour crafting. Oh, you may want him to come on the show. Has he come on the show?
Yeah, you introduced me to him,
and he came
on the show about 2 years ago.
That's right. So,
what's his name? I can't pronounce it. I forget. What?
Baruch Koshnevis. Professor Koshnevis is a very creative and inventive person.
Yeah, he came on the show as a result of your introducing me to him.
Oh, that's right. And so you know, I was working with him at that time and creating an idea for how to land heavy payloads on the moon. And we said we could use contour crafting to build the landing pad. And he had gone further out and thought about new ideas, and hopefully it's time for him to come back again, because he just won another NASA prize for doing some very creative work. Anyhow, so I was working on this area when the student came up and said she really was having difficulties finding a midterm project. And I told her, why don't you look at, you know, 3D printing?
Yeah.
And then we went on to study 3D printing, and she did a very nice job and presented a paper. And that paper caught on fire because, you know, Wired and so on talked about it. And since that time, people have been calling me to talk about 3D printing of food. And Chapman U has a food science department, and they called me several times, but I was busy. It's only now that I was able to talk with them about it. And the idea is very simple, David, and that is you want to provide an astronaut in probably a very high-stress environment with the finest foods we can possibly imagine. And our dream is this. Our dream is that it may be possible for the astronaut in a very long endurance, long mission, to have foods that are made at home and sampled by computer and sent over as a data file to the spaceship where it is reconstituted from a variety of other materials on the spacecraft. And lo and behold, come breakfast, you smell food from family. And that is the holy grail, if you want to call it that. But as of now, 3D printing of food is happening already. Even things like artificial food, artificial meat, is being produced by 3D printing. I think many of the readers and many of the listeners would know that artificial organs and tissue is already being made using 3D printing methods. Are you familiar with Wake Forest Field? Yeah.
Yeah, I am familiar with
that
too. And
Dr. Atala is doing some incredible work on building tracheas. You know, they have scaffolds on which they impregnate cells using 3D printing, David. And then they grow. And, I think recently there was the idea that, you know, people suffering burns, severe burns, can have skin 3D printed back on them using similar methods. So 3D printing of food is happening, and Made in Space is already doing 3D printing in space.
Right. They just have a new printer going up, too.
That's right. I hope the next step of 3D printing would be 3D printing of food, David. And do you want to start a business with me?
I want to taste it first.
That's true.
Have you tasted any 3D printed food?
No, I have not. I have not. And I hope to do that, too.
Well, let me know when you taste the 3D printed meat, okay?
Do you remember the Nazi era when they invented the Fischer-Tropsch process for making artificial butter?
Yes.
Yeah, and I think Hitler's comment was interesting when he said, "It looks good, it tastes good. It feels good, but it tastes like you know what." Or some such thing.
Something like that, right? I don't know the German word for that. I know the French word for it.
Me too. Yeah.
Pretty soon the replicator from Star Trek will be in full force on the space station, won't it?
Well, I think all those things are coming about, and what is impressive is that the race, how fast we accelerate towards technologies. In the genetics arena, there is a thing called CRISPR-Cas9. Have you read about that?
No.
It is a technique that was accidentally discovered about 10 years ago, but they have now moved up in precision gene editing. That means you can literally go in there into your DNA and pull out very specific switches and triggers and turn them on or off, creating new mutations, David.
So what is this called? Let me write it down.
CRISPR, C-R-S-P-R, Google George Church, and hopefully he'll come or Craig Venter will come and talk.
Well, Craig Venter I've met before, but I'm trying to remember if he came on the show or not. I met him at a conference at NASA Ames several years ago.
I love that man. You know, the slides that he shows, I would love for my students to see how to be clear in their presentation. You know, there's very few people who can do that, you know. Craig Venter's slides are good, yeah.
So, but what is the name of the process called?
CRISPR, C-R-S-P-R, all caps.
Okay, CRISPR.
Yeah, look at it and then see.
Well, I'm really listening.
I mean, there is even a wiki on it. You'll be able to see.
Yeah, I'm really interested in it because, you know, they're making incredible genetic progress in transferring genes in cystic fibrosis, and that affects my younger son. So that they're actually getting it to last in people and not doing any harm. So the progress moves on, Madhu, for sure.
Oh, yes, indeed. And with fast computation on the side, these things become magical. I think Craig Venter just put out Cynthia 2. Are you following Craig's work?
No, I'm not. I should be. But
okay, now Craig Venter, what he did was he pulled out the nucleus of a cell and retweaked it, and it worked. And then he decided he was going to build the entire sequence of the nucleus of the DNA from scratch and put it back in there, and it worked. And now he has gone ahead and brought up a new version of this new cell in which he removed all the parts that he thinks are not necessary and just left enough for a cell to reproduce. And he calls it Cynthia 2 or Cynthia 3, I'm not sure. But the damn cell is working.
Do you know him? Are you friends with him?
No, I know him, but I've heard him talk, but I've not had many discussions with him. But you should surely send him an email.
Do you have his address?
Oh, it's easy to find. I think it's called Craig Venter Institute. I think. Oh, he was another one of those people who jump ship one after the other because of bureaucracy, you know. And his fingers are itching to do real work. So whenever he thought things were getting heavy in the bureaucratic area, he'd just jump ship and build a new company.
good for him.
But as you know, Craig Venter is the man, again, who accelerated the U.S. government to produce the Human Genome Project. And that's an important lesson for our listeners to know the role of government. You know, when you think the government is sleepy, or when the Department of Health or Center for Disease Control or whatever, when you think they're sleeping, is when the private industry really starts to shine. They can do things at a fraction of what it takes the government to do, and before you know it, the government is the target of Congress, and you're going like, "What are you guys doing? You're sleeping," you know. So when bad governance comes in the picture, private sector can play an incredible role in accelerating the process. And Craig Venter is the man who did it for the Human Genome Project.
When you talked about 3D of printing food at Chapman, were you well received?
Oh gosh, thanks for asking. So now, this professor who heads the department has 12 students, kind of like my studio, you know. And so I'm sitting in her room. I came in a few minutes early to chat with her. And then she says, we have a little bit of difficulty because the class won't accept, don't have enough space. And I said, what's the problem? I said, oh, we want to get the larger room. And he said, how many? 120? So a 12 student class ended up being 120 wonderful, wonderful, enthusiastic students from various departments. And they had some tricky questions, which I dodged because I don't know the answer to some of these questions. And but it was a very fun event, and I particularly liked Glassell Circle and the restaurants there, David. The campus is very pretty. There are very many new buildings,
yeah,
including a great library and main library and a music center.
And a law school, too.
And a law school, that's right.
And their film school is really tops.
Tops, yeah, you know. So it's a beautiful campus, and you wouldn't expect to see that driving right into the middle of Orange, you know.
So summarize us up for today, because we're approaching 2 hours now.
Oh, great. So Now, I would suggest, as a first prerequisite before they read this article about the U.S. Department of Space, that they go to that article and click on the slides that were presented, at least look over the introduction slides and the conclusion slides.
Now, which article is this?
Ooh, the one that appeared on Space Daily, I think a couple of weeks ago, right, David? I sent it to you, right?
I don't remember. That's not one that I printed out for today's show, so I don't know.
Oh, is that right?
You may not have sent me that one, so send it to me.
Okay, and in there, you know, it's really an older article because I penned that article in 2012, just after we finished that team project at USC, and it appeared in Space News.
Okay.
And then I got a whole ton unloaded on me at that time. But now it has appeared with a few revisions and editions and edits and so on. And so first I want them to read that. And then they want to look at the slides and comment on it. And I know it is a hard thing to swallow, but I still believe that good governance is a prerequisite for good commerce. And there are many, many instances in the development of aviation, development of high technology, where good governance was the key, including the Manhattan Project and the radar and so on and so forth. So with that, I'll conclude on the U.S. Department of Space. But I really want to tell you that our fall project for AST 527 in this incredible Department of Astronautical Engineering, you know, there are not very many astronautical engineering departments that do hard astronautical engineering and a very nice curriculum. David, I think you know that, you know.
Right.
And I hope you get Mike Gruntman to come and talk about all the incredible things he is doing to make this a very, very special program. We are so, so lucky to have a faculty that allows new visions and creativity to happen. You had Bruce Cardell come on the air, right?
Yeah, Bruce was on about his Maslow windows.
That's right. You know, and Bruce talks, Bruce teaches human space exploration at USC, and I think he just finished his finals because I had one or two students send me and said, now we are brainwashed, it's all about Mars. Oh, that's great. So we have an incredible program in the USC Astronautics Department and within the Viterbi School of Engineering, and hope students look over that curriculum and apply to the program because you know we depend on very bright youngsters to
absolutely
to do the good work for me. And this term, in the fall term, we're going to be looking at analogs and simulators for long duration space activity, David.
Okay.
And I would recommend that they go pull out the syllabus, and the whole topic is listed there, and they can take a quick read. Because, you know, when we get into complex missions, I mean, we've done this all the time, not just for space, including all the complex engineering for vehicles and systems from nuclear reactors to complicated hospital procedures and critical care, so space is not an exception to this kind of thinking, where we do dress rehearsals. You know, that's why we have buoyancy tanks at JSC, you know, where they build and assemble things. So in that same way, we think there's a lot to learn from analogs and simulations on Earth, and we will visit them. We will visit and see if there are new and creative ways to study a long-duration mission.
Do they contact you for information about the program?
Well, I have good news first and then bad news. The good news is we are going to have an exciting team. Already we are lining up the movers and shakers in the industry. you know, Bob Zubrin and others, we'd love for them to come and talk about the Mars station, the desert station, and so on.
Uh-huh.
The bad news is the studio, as always, is oversubscribed. And I feel bad because I get these emails and they go like, oh, Professor, can I get in? Too late, too late. Because, you know, I think Dr. Grumpen very clearly puts into the newsletter that, you know, students must apply early because it's a very tight group. I can only admit so many students. But they can always be on the waiting list for the next year, you know.
Or someone dropping out if they have to drop out for some reason.
Well, I was mentioning this to the faculty. Very few drop out. And maybe it's a good idea to have a waiting list and see things happen that way. But in general, the class just goes, and we always have, I like to call it the funnest graduate class in town.
The funnest graduate class in town. Okay.
Students work. Many of them come directly from the industry. So the mechanics rubs off very nicely because a few are students from USC, and many of them are from the industry with a lot of work experience. So when at midterm they start showing off their spiffy slides and the way they create their ideas around things and the various visiting lecturers who come and talk, and finally, you know, the products they produce, they're so excited, and some of them go ahead and produce manuscripts for conferences, and like the space 2016 coming up in Long Beach, and
right.
So all of those things excite my students to do very well, and it's an interesting class, David.
All right. Well, listen, it's been great talking to you again, and thank you for coming back, and we'll see where the Department of Space goes.
Thank you so much, David. I want to comment to you on that incredible new website. I had no idea this was going on, but now I do. And it's always good to see, it's always good to come talk with you, and wishing you all the best, both for the Department of, both for the Department of Space, for the space show. And one more thing, David.
Yes.
Do you think that the space show t-shirt will ever come back?
Well, you can order it off of Cafe Press on our store, but we're putting a new logo out on our items on the store. So right now the store is offline because people, if they bought the items with the old logo on it, they'd be PO'd. So we've got it offline until we put the new logo up on all of the different items, but we don't give them away anymore. The cost of mailing are just prohibitive, and if you don't like that, then, you know, vote for a different set of politicians that don't drive inflation up.
Let me tell you something. The quality of those t-shirts are incredible.
Well, not anymore. I forget where the original ones were made, but then they shifted them to, let's see, where did they go? They went to Nicaragua, and they unraveled in the washing machine, and then they went to another Central American country. I don't remember which one, and they were marginally better than Nicaragua, but not much better. And but the price went up 30%, and the postage has more than doubled.
Oh,
so
God.
It's just not possible to give them away anymore.
Well, let me tell you something. The quality of those T-shirts are such that I've had them from the first time you emailed them to me. I still wear them, and I have three of them, David. So now, if you want an antique T-shirt sent back to you, we can discuss and negotiate.
No, I still have my original ones, but the ones with the new logo will be much nicer, and hopefully I can get the store back online quickly with all the items showing the new logo.
Oh.
So, and then I'll tell you about it. But that's the only way you can get Space Show T-shirts now is through the store, and they handle all the shipping and the processing and everything else.
I see. But and let me conclude with this, David. The only thing that is of higher quality than that T-shirt that's probably lasted more than 10 years now. I don't know. When did I first come on air, David? Many years ago.
I don't know, but the show is 15 years old this month.
There you go. It's about that long.
So it's been about that
long. All three T-shirts have survived to date. I still wear them. The only thing of more higher quality than those T-shirts I can imagine is your talk show, David.
Well, thank you. We're coming up on 15 years. So
that's amazing. And how many interviews?
Coming up on 3,000.
Oh, great. That's wonderful to hear. Keep up the good work, David.
Well, thank you, and I'll get the archived information to you as soon as possible.
Very good. And did you want me to send the URL to the article again? Is it what you wanted?
Absolutely. Okay. Absolutely. And also to Baruch, and I'll email him again.
Oh, please do. And I'll send you a few more people.
Okay.
I think would
And that other person... Forget his name already.
Philip Lubin.
Lubin,
I want Philip Lubin to talk to you. Yeah.
Okay, will do. Thank you, Madhu.
Thank you so very much.
All right, have a great week. And listeners, Dennis Wingo is our guest for tomorrow evening, 7 p.m. California time. Be with us, please.
Oh, Dennis is a cool guy. I saw him at the Ames conference a couple of months ago. Yeah, he's
always exceptional.
Get him to talk the moon again. Talk up the moon again.
Absolutely. Thank you, Madhu. Everybody.
Wonderful to talk with you, okay. David.
Everybody have a great week, and thank you for listening to The Space Show.